We continue our year-long survey through all the prophecy, not every last bit of it, but preaching through prophecy in 2022. And we are moving to our next subset of this series, and that is today we're going to start on the book of Daniel. How many of you have read the first couple of chapters? Ooh, gold stars for all of you. Very good. The way that I'm describing our time in the book of Daniel is we need to dare to be a Daniel. We need to trust God. Because that is one of the things that is characteristic of Daniel himself. And many of the things that occur in the book of Daniel show up again in the book of Revelation. And so it's good background for what we'll be doing later in the year. So I want you to turn to the book of Daniel, and we're going to do the first two chapters today. A lot of it, though, is going to be rereading things because it's self-explanatory. I'll throw a little commentary in from here and then, but it'll be the second chapter that we'll start talking more about the prophetic things. So the book of Daniel comes from the time period starting at about 605 BC. In that year, Nebuchadnezzar was the crown prince of the growing Babylonian Empire. His dad had actually rebelled against the Assyrian Empire at the start of his own reign. And the Assyrian Empire was very much, that was the Nazis of their day. I mean, they didn't consider anyone that was not Assyrian to be real humans. They were just resources to be used. And so Babylon was under the boot of the Assyrians when Nabopolassar, which would be Nebuchadnezzar's dad, said, enough is enough, we want freedom for our country. And so they chased the Assyrians out of their country, and once they put them on the run, Nabopolassar just stayed on them. He decided he wanted to annihilate the Assyrian Empire. And so in 605 BC, Crown Prince Nebuchadnezzar was sent out to do some mopping up of the remnants of the Assyrian Empire. And the Egyptians were acting as allies to the Assyrians. So when Nebuchadnezzar went far west from his country of Babylon, almost to the Mediterranean, he wiped the floor with the Assyrians and then chased the Egyptians far south, all the way down to the border of Egypt. When he finished with that operation, he immediately came back to the nearest huge city, which was Jerusalem, which had been forced to be subservient to the Egyptians as allies to the Assyrians. And that is where our story picks up, is Nebuchadnezzar coming to Jerusalem. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So he put his forces around it and basically told them, you need to surrender because I've already dealt with the Egyptians that you've been serving. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Common practice, when you, as a Babylonian, win over a city, you make them give some of the items that are associated with your God as presents to your God. To basically say, my God beat your God, give me your God's stuff. I'm taking it back to show it to my God. And so that's exactly what he did. But as he was in the process of doing all this stuff, he got a fast message from Mesopotamia. His dad had died. And he needed to immediately get back to Babylon to be declared the new king of Babylon, the new emperor of the Babylonian Empire. And so before he left, this is one of the things that he did as the new king. Verse number 3. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food, from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Again, not unusual. What would happen is when you brought a new area under your control as a king, you would need people from that new area to serve in your administration. They would tell you what their culture and thinking was like, but then you would educate them in everything about your culture, your history, your background, your language, so that they would become part of this new country, or in this case, empire, that they were now part of. It was a vested sort of arrangement. These guys did kind of serve as political hostages of a sort, but more, they were kind of the new bridge that Nebuchadnezzar wanted to use from his empire to Judah becoming part of that empire. And so he wanted people that were already well advanced in their educational pursuits. So we're probably talking about later teens, maybe very early 20s. And they were royal family members or members of the leaders in the city of Jerusalem and in the country of Judah. And that's where we meet our heroes. It says, now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. Common practice. How many of you took a foreign language in school? Did you get a foreign name? You remember that? Same sort of thing here, okay? So here's their new names. To Daniel, he assigned the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. Now, some of the name components in the new names have to do with gods of the Babylonians. And so that is, again, very common practice. So they get moved from Jerusalem to their new country. They've got 3 years that they're supposed to be educated. And they are also to be privileged with eating from the royal restaurant. They're supposed to be eating the exact same menu, the exact same wine choices that the king and all of his people eat from. But this is a problem for Jewish people, because Jewish people are kosher. There are certain meats that are totally off the menu, and actually, even the meats on the menu have to be prepared a very specific way. Same thing with a lot of the foods, the dishes. They have to be prepared the same way. The wine has to be vinted in a very specific way to be counted as kosher. And so Daniel and his three friends, as good religious Jews, have a problem. Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are of your own age? And then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. So his concern is, are you kidding me? This is the top-notch diet in our society. This is the best of the best. If I don't feed it to you and you don't look as good as everybody else, it's for me. Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Neither one of those are problematic. Fresh vegetables can be prepared in a kosher fashion no matter where they were grown. And water, always kosher. Then, after the 10 days, let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food. Deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened because God softened this guy's heart. Remember that from an earlier verse? So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. Now, don't over-apply the word fatter there. It's a reference to their skin looked full and elasticity was perfect. So they looked healthy. They had a healthy glow to them that the other guys did not have. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink and kept giving them vegetables. Now, that appears to only be for Daniel and his three friends. The other guys are like, no, we want to eat the really good food. And as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. And Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. That comes up in the next chapter. And then at the end of the days, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. So this was the deal. At the end of the education period, which God is helping these guys with, they're absorbing new languages, they're reading things from all over the libraries of the Babylonian archives and histories from hundreds, even thousand years before. For that, and so they are being helped by God to absorb all this stuff and be able to be at the top of their class. Graduation day comes, every last one of these people are interviewed by the king before he decides whichever country he's looking at, which of these individuals are going to be put on my advisory council from this particular country. And we hear this: the king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. So they become the Judean advisors in King Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian empire. And as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. Now, don't think of a sleight of hand artist for magicians. Think about these guys being the magi of that day. They were exceptionally well-versed in all of the literature, the history, the background, the languages. They also were tapped into the spiritual side of the empire. They knew not just their own religion, but tons of religions. And so when Daniel and these guys are in council with the king goes, man, you guys just have so much better advice than all these guys that have been around here for a long time. I appreciate that. Thank you. And so Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. That's almost 70 years in the future. So he is here in this kingdom and into the next kingdom after this as a prominent person because of God. Chapter number 2. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, which is going to be the third calendar year, the first year is the accession year. So it's after Daniel and his friends have already been brought on staff. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. And we know that it is God that sent this dream. Then the king gave orders to call all the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, all the advisors, the top-notch guys, the guys that have been in service to his father, the old guys. And he called them to tell the king his dreams, so that they came in and they stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream. My spirit is anxious to understand the dream. And then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. That's the universal language of the Middle East at this time. O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation. And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the command for me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream first, basically, and its interpretation second, you will be torn limb from limb and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and reward and great honor, and therefore declare to me the dream and its interpretation. They answered him a second time, said, well, just let the king tell the dream to his servants and we will interpret, we'll give you the interpretation. This is the way they'd always worked before. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you are bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command for me is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you, for you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. Now, this man is in his later 30s. He's just now become the king at the passing of his father within the last few years of a sprawling empire. And he is not sure at this point he can trust his advisors. And he's definitely wanting to put them to the test. And in his mind, the test is, if you guys are tapped into the spirit world, you shouldn't be able to just simply tell me what my dream means. You should be able to tell me my dream. Now, my opinion is God was actually making him this hard-nosed about it. Next, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there's not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose mortal place is not with mortal, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. So their response is, nobody's ever asked us to do this before. What are you doing? This is stuff only the gods know, and the gods come down to us infrequently on their own schedule. Because of this, the king became indignant and very furious, and he gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And so the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. Now, this is the roundup. They're not just killing them where they find them. They're rounding them all up to bring them to the king for execution. So nobody's died yet. Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who'd gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. And he answered and said to Arioch, the king's commander, what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? So what's the rush? And Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in, and he requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. So he makes an official request as a junior counselor. Remember, he's probably only about 20 or something. He makes a request as a junior counselor. Can I have one more night so that I can see if I can find this out? And then he was given that time. Daniel then went to his house and informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, about the matter, in order that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So they have a prayer meeting together. The three heroes. And then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Nebuchadnezzar had a dream last night. Daniel has the dream tonight. But Daniel is also given the meaning of the dream at the same time. So the next morning, he wakes up and Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And Daniel answered and said this. And I want you to pay attention to the wording here. Remember how last week I was talking about how the fact that prophecy is one of the ways that the identity of God as the one and only true God is shown. That shows up in Daniel's words. Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is He who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men, knowledge to men of understanding. It is He who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what's in the darkness, and the light dwells with Him. See, He's the God of prophecy. To Thee, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for You have given me wisdom and power. Even now You've made known to me what we requested of You, for You have made known to us the king's matter. So their prayer was answered, and now they're ready to go to the king. Therefore, Daniel went in to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows: "Don't destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence. I will declare the interpretation to the king." Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence, spoke to him as follows: "I've found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king." Now, the king already has met him several occasions, but Arioch wants to get his two cents worth in, you know. "Hey, I found the guy that can help you out." The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have sent and its interpretation? So can you first describe to me the dream?" Daniel answered before the king and said, "Well, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However," now listen to these words again, "there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and He has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the later days. This was your dream and the visions of your mind while on your bed. Now, as for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future. And He has revealed to, and He who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind." So Daniel says, "This is not about me, king. This is about you and God. And God knew that you were wondering about your future. And not just your future. You were wondering about the future well beyond you. And God has given you that information in the dream. You, O king, we're looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome." Now, immediately, you can almost imagine Nebuchadnezzar going, "Yes, that's what I saw." Keep going. "The head of that statue was made of fine gold. Its breast, its chest, and its arms of silver. Its belly, the abdomen, and its thighs were made of bronze. Its legs were made of iron, and, if we don't have enough detail yet, its feet, partly of iron and partly of clay." Now, again, imagine Nebuchadnezzar. "Yes, yes, yes, that's exactly it." Now, think about the randomness of being able to name all of that specificity and be right. It is impossible for him to have told Nebuchadnezzar this stuff by guesswork. This is the power of prophecy. It proves that Daniel is in touch with the God of the universe, the God who gave Nebuchadnezzar this dream. And because of that, Nebuchadnezzar is going to be able to trust Daniel in the interpretation of it, which is what he wanted to begin with. Now, that's not the end of the dream, is it? It says, "You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet and clay of iron and clay and crushed them." And then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed all at the same time. So the whole thing comes crashing down and it's gone. It became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that there was not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Nebuchadnezzar, yes, 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 yes. That's exactly what happened in my dream. You got it spot on from beginning to end. Now, the big thing. This was the dream. Now, we shall tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the King of Kings, that's a Babylonian title, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory, and wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he's given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. Now, you remember again, last week I told you, unfulfilled prophecy. One of the best ways we find out about it being fulfilled is the Bible itself tells us what it is. This is one of those times. We've got zero doubt on this statue, the Babylonians are the head of gold. Verse 39, after you, not him personally, but after the empire of the Babylonians, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you. Now, we know that silver is not as precious as gold, but we also know that silver is harder than gold. There's a weird thing that happens in this statue. It goes from soft to hard and from precious to less precious. If there's extra significance to that, there might be. It's been suggested in a lot of the commentaries. But the big thing is we know that the Babylonians were followed in their relationship to the Jewish people by the Medes and the Persians, starting in 539 BC. And this four sequence of kingdoms shows up in later parts of the book of Daniel, and it also shows up in a foursome in the book of Revelation. Then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. This would be Alexander the Great. His Macedonian Greeks swept across the Middle East starting in 333 BC, and that is a long time after Daniel is giving this interpretation. This is not guesswork. This is Daniel giving God work. And it's interesting, just as a sideline, the Greeks were known for using bronze weapons and armor. Then, verse 40, there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so that like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these pieces. The next empire that swept onto the scene of the Middle East was the Roman Empire. It was a republic when it first crashed into the area around 63 BC. They came into kind of really close contact with the Jewish people. The Jewish kingdom became tributary to the Romans in 63 BC. And one of the things we know about the Romans is they used iron and steel weapons. And it's one of the reasons that they really did in the Greeks is because their weaponry was harder and more advanced. And so it's not surprising then we find that metal being described here in the passage. But we're still not done, are we? There's still more to the story. Now, we're going to talk about how you saw the feet of toes, partly of potter's clay, partly of iron. It will be divided kingdoms, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. Now, one of the things that we find out about the Roman Empire over its full life is that it had a hard time adhering to one another because it was made up of a lot of different people groups. I'm going to come back to that one later, because I think that's one of the parts of the passage here that points to a more future application. But verse number 44, in the days of those kings, meaning these four kingdoms that we already see here, the Babylonians, Medes, Macedonian Greeks, the Romans, which actually bits and pieces of them all kept going into the next group. We still use 12 as a calendar and as a clock system, 360-degree circle. All that comes from the Babylonians. The Medes and the Persians, we get a lot of stuff from them as well that is still in our society to this day. The Greeks, it also passed down to us. A lot of the Greek democracy sort of things came to us. The Romans as well, many of their customs and traditions. We still use Latin in a lot of our technical stuff. All of this stuff continued until this next event happened. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven, who set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all of these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. When we look at this passage, we cannot help but think about how Jesus came as the stone of God, the stone which the builders rejected, the stone that was cut out, not by human hands, but God's hands. How Jesus came in the time of the Romans and changed everything. And then we can talk about how Jesus' kingdom is actually started in a spiritual fashion in the days of his first coming, because the church belongs to his kingdom. We are the parts of that kingdom. And so it is interesting that this is the direction that the postmillennialists and the amillennialists want to go whenever they deal with this passage. And I understand that because it makes good sense that Jesus is ruling and reigning in our hearts as Christians here. He's ruling and reigning with his saints in heaven already. The Roman Catholic Church actually believed, because they're postmillennialists, that when they became the new religion of the Roman Empire, that they kind of replaced the Roman Empire. And so that's the direction a lot of the postmillennialists and amillennialists will go with this, is that they will spiritualize some of these passages. And I want you to be aware of that, and some of you may actually believe that, and that's fine. Because remember, last week we talked about this, that this is not a matter of faith. But I do want you to understand that premillennialists, they feel that there needs to be a focus on a little bit more of the vision, and that it goes a little bit farther into the future. And that happens to be the stand that I take, and I'm going to give you that right now for your consideration. And that means we need to zoom in on the legs. And we need to talk about the fact that the Roman Republic became an empire in 27 BC. When the New Testament starts, it was Roman Empire time. But the Roman Empire broke into two pieces on purpose in 285. And it became the Eastern and the Western Rome Empire. And then both of those empires, the Western disintegrated faster than the Eastern, but both of them disintegrated over time during the 5th to the 15th centuries into a whole bunch of kingdoms. Those kingdoms spat with one another, but also intermarried with one another. That sounds very much like the talk about the feet of clay mixed with pottery clay mixed with iron, where it doesn't really want to adhere all that well with one another, but it still keeps on trying, and that there's intermarriage in the kingdoms. You understand, even to this day, the royal houses, most of them are only honorary now, of Europe, are all intermarried. They're all intermixed. Well, that all started happening during this disintegration period. And then those kingdoms became the modern countries that we know today, all over Europe, during the 15th and through the 20th centuries. And here's another thing that we know. There have been multiple attempts over that time period to try to bring the Roman Empire back. Charlemagne tried it with the Holy Roman Empire. The Germans have tried it three times now. First Reich, Second Reich, Third Reich, they've tried it. The Russians have tried it, and apparently they're trying it again right now. And we understand that every time they've tried to put the Roman Empire back together again, it hasn't worked very well. It eventually falls apart again. But it does, the hope of it does not always disappear. The EU, the European Union right now, is actually an attempt to economically revive the Roman Empire interaction with one another. And a lot of the member countries are part of the ancient territory of the Roman Empire. Premillennialists, because of the Book of Revelation's retelling of these beasts, it tells beasts instead of statue bits. It tells beasts in the Book of Revelation. Many premillennialists believe eventually, right before Jesus Christ comes back, they will succeed in putting something back together again. And that the horn leader, coming later in the book of Daniel, and what usually they refer as Antichrist, but that doesn't appear in the book of Revelation. The beast leader in the book of Revelation is the last emperor of that last empire, which is revived. And because of that, premillennialists believe that what's going to happen is Jesus' second coming hits that final empire in the book of Revelation, disintegrates it, and then his kingdom is the millennium of Revelation chapter 20, which is just the first tiny bit stage of the eternal kingdom of Jesus Christ. So I've given you there both ways of looking at this passage of Scripture. Now, we're not done, because the king now says this. He says, verse 46, "The king Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense to treat him with exceptional respect. And the king answered Daniel and said, 'Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery.'" Do you see that? He acknowledges the power of prophecy. "This proves your God is the best God that's out there." Now, he didn't quit believing in other gods and goddesses, but he acknowledged at this point, your God did something that nobody else could do. And that's the power of prophecy. Now, the next thing that happens is this. "The king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made requests of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court." This is the mechanism by which God moves Daniel from a junior counselor, probably only about 20-some years of age, to the senior counselor. Not just of Nebuchadnezzar, but he's going to be around for a while. And he is also going to be making sure that Jewish writings get put into the Babylonian archives, which the Magi later will use to come and find Jesus, born the King of Kings and Lord of Lords at Bethlehem. Now, how does this all impact us? Well, it's this. We see demonstrated here the power of prophecy. And we know this for a fact. Even though we might not be able to agree, all of us, in how this all plays out in the end, we know this. Jesus' kingdom will be the one that survives every human kingdom. He is the King of Kings. He is the Lord of Lords. He is already that to us. And when he comes the next time, he will be that to everyone. Because at his name, at his presence, every knee shall bow, every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is he who is. He is Lord to the glory of God the Father. And that is the next big event we as Christians are looking forward to, is him splitting the sky and coming back to give us our new bodies, transform us, if we're still alive, and bring us into his eternal presence. And we need to bring as many people with us as we possibly can. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the power of prophecy. We thank you for the prophet Daniel, for the fact that he had faith in you. He trusted you. So that even as a young man, he stood up to the people much older and more authoritative than him and, And he said, no, I need to do it God's way. And you rewarded him for that, Lord, and you made him somebody that still impacts on our life today. So, Father, help us all to dare to be like Daniel. Help us to trust you and to keep our eyes open for ways that we can impact other people for your kingdom's sake. It is in the name of Christ that we pray. Amen.